Okay, well, we might get started. My name is Alistair Spears. I'm a senior operations PM at Microsoft. I work in the Office Deployment, Adoption, and Readiness team, part of the Technical Product Management group. So our role is really to sit between the engineering teams, the sales, the marketing, partners, customers, and those sorts of things, and really help you guys drive deployment, adoption, and readiness, and really those core IT pro roles of the future as well. Here today with Jeff Medford.
Hi, Jeff Medford, and I'm a product manager on the same team with Alistair, and I own and drive deployment for Office 365. So deployment programs, deployment methodology worldwide for Office 365 across all workloads for there.
So we've been spending a lot of time, we spent a lot of time on the road actually, and not in Redmond, but traveling around, visiting customers and partners around the world, and kind of talking about Office 365 and how it's changed, how they're using it, you know, the challenges that they have with Office 365 and those sorts of things as well. We've been doing this for quite some time, and it's interesting to note the changes. And so we decided to put together a little video just to give you a sneak peek of how the conversation with Office 365, with IT pros has been going as people move to Office 365. So let me just jump up here, and let's get this started.
"365, 365. I do not like 365.
Would you, could you, on a bus? Would you, could you, edit docs?
Who in the...
Would you, could you show cool maps with Power BI and Office web apps?
I would not, could not show BI, not without 365.
Enjoy new freedom. You will see, use any device, productivity.
Any device? I can't agree. And on my phone, you let me be. Nope. Mm-mm. No.
High SLA at 99.9. Would you, could you have that uptime?
All right. If you will let me be, I will try it, and you'll see. Ooh, hey, I like 365. There's loads of space on my OneDrive, and I would use it on a bus, Link and Word without a fuss. SharePoint sites, Exchange to boot. I stay plugged in on my commute.
Link and Word without a fuss.
I do so like 365. Thank you, thank you.
Who are you talking to?
It seemed funnier when we made it up. So we're going to talk a lot about what goes on inside of Office 365, you know, how Office 365 is architectured, and why, as IT pros, we shouldn't really treat Office 365 as a black box. It's important for us to understand it. You know, a few years ago, when the cloud was all the rage, it was the new hotness, everyone was talking about the cloud, 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 and in many ways they still are. But back then, we had really interesting and weird conversations around cloud in general and Office 365 in particular. We'd have some, you know, salespeople and business managers kind of stare up at the sky when they talk about Office 365 as this, as if it's some sort of, you know, satellite system or something like that. And the reality is that it's much more mundane than cool satellites all around the world, but it's still pretty interesting as well. And the other thing that's really changed is that we're all using clouds now, even if we don't realize it. We're using them at home, for our personal email, online gaming. You know, the Xbox One now runs essentially 3 servers in Azure for every box that's online at any given time. Social networking, storage, where you store your photos, where you stream your music, where you're watching video on demand, or even security patches and updates and antivirus and all these other sorts of things are really coming from the cloud. And so people have got a lot more used to the cloud over this time, and so we've stopped having those conversations about, you know, why should we go to the cloud? And it's really changed this kind of conversation about when. You know, the decision's often made despite us IT pros, someone else makes the decision on an economical reason or something like that, and then it's our job just to yes sir, no sir, and implement the system. But it's still important that we understand that, and it's still important that we understand what's going on as well. And for Office 365, it is more than just a cloud service. You know, we talk a lot about cloud. You heard Jeff this morning talk a lot about cloud services as well. But the important thing to realize and understand is that Office 365 is all of our productivity services running in a public cloud environment. But in addition to that, it's all the latest apps. And when we think about all of those apps, we think about all the tools that you use to do your best work, whether they're on your PC, whether they're on your laptop, your mobile phone, your tablet, or essentially any other device that you do to get your work done. We want to make sure that the best productivity tool is Office on those devices. So we're really focused on, you know, whatever device comes out next year, we want to make sure that it runs. You know, if we go back to the Office 2010 launch, you know, it seems like not that long ago, I'm sure many people in this room are still using Office 2010. The iPad wasn't even released yet when we released Office 2010. Kind of an amazing change that's going on in the industry. So we really had to adapt so that we can quickly deliver these apps on various platforms that matter to you, the users, and to the IT organizations that buy those devices, or the users that bring those devices into the organization themselves. Coupled with that, we want to make sure that we can provide these enterprise-grade cloud services. It's not enough, you know, if you've grown up on SharePoint, you've grown up on Exchange, and grown up on Link, it's not enough to take a step backward just to get into the cloud. You don't want to lose functionality. You don't want to lose features. We want to make sure that these cloud services are as feature complete, if not more feature complete, than what you have on premises as well. And that's really what we're building in Office 365, these two things together. Let's call out a couple of things down the bottom here. These are kind of some of our themes that we really think about productivity in. And a lot of people ask us, well, you guys have been building Office for 30 years. Aren't you done yet? Like, isn't productivity as productive as you can be? And the answer is no, because the world keeps changing, the way that we work keeps changing, and we identify different trends that we need to tackle and help improve people's work lives every day, every month, new things come up. So one of them is this notion of a dynamic workplace. You know, the notion of, instead of just having an organization full of employees, now your organization is almost this kind of use the term loosely, network of different people. You have not only employees, but you have contractors, vendors, suppliers, customers, partners, all these different people that actually form part of that kind of connected workflow of whatever it is your business or your organization does. So this dynamic workplace really plays havoc on kind of our minds as IT pros, because all of a sudden now it's not necessarily the Active Directory that's the single point of truth. That's not where everyone is. That's where your employees are. You don't necessarily want to give everyone else a different account. You want to be able to log in. You want to form these groups. Sometimes you may even have competitors that you need to collaborate with. You know, the whole notion of a standards body is you get a whole bunch of competitors together and you try and work out a standard that helps move the whole industry forward. And so those sorts of things, you kind of need to let in your enemies into your environment to share and collaborate in these sorts of things, but still be able to protect everything else in your organization as well. Making sense of it all, you saw some of the cool things with Oslo, you saw some great things with Power BI that Julia White demoed this morning as well. But really we understand that there's more and more data that we're all dealing with, more databases, more content, more documents, and those sorts of things. And it's harder and harder to kind of keep that all straight in your mind. So things like Power BI and things like Oslo and using this kind of search infrastructure to start to service business intelligence is a really big investment area for us as well. When we think about home and work, you know, we think about that the role also changing. It's no longer that people clock in at 9, clock out at 5. They're working throughout the day. They may be working odd hours. They may take work home, and they may also do home stuff at work. You know, how many people have taken personal calls at work, done other things, booked holidays, those sorts of things. And the nature of our day is not so linearly defined anymore, and so we want to make sure that the tools that you use in your day-to-day job can actually work with that as well. And you can manage those things on a shared calendar, a consistent calendar, the consistent technologies as well. Natural expression, that's another one that's key. And that's really the move away from kind of keyboards and mice. You know, that's one great input method, and obviously we're going to continue supporting keyboard and mice. We also want to support new scenarios like touch, like voice activation, like other things that just help that technology just be embedded into your day-to-day workflow as well. So you don't have to get out, look at your phone while you're driving or something like that. You can use voice access and those sorts of capabilities in Office 365. And finally, this notion of a responsible organization. You know, all this technology is awesome. I think Bill Clinton did a great job of talking about the power of technology as well. But as we use more and more technology, organizations get much more sophisticated at how they view technology. It's no longer that the only people that understood technology are in the IT department. You have business users that are very smart with IT. You have governments that are very smart with IT as well. And we see increasing levels of regulation, compliance, capabilities, and policies to help manage that organization. And increasingly, it's become the role of IT to help manage that and help keep that organization safe and secure and make sure that your organization can continue to operate as well. So kind of one of the key things that we really want to call out and hopefully you take away from this is don't treat the cloud as a mysterious black box. It's great that you can do that with Hotmail or with Gmail or one of those other services, the consumer services, where it's kind of set and forget. But as an IT professional, what makes us professionals is that we understand the tools that our users are using. Otherwise, we're just kind of IT consumers like everyone else. And so for professionals, we absolutely want to make sure that you know what's going on under the covers with Office 365 so you don't treat it like a black box. So with that, Jeff, how about you tell us why the cloud's not so fluffy and how it really looks
That's right.
underneath all of that.
It looks like a lot of servers and data centers and places around the world. And we had a question pre to the session about where do you have your data? Where is data stored? What are some of the thoughts from Microsoft's perspective on data? And I'll show you this slide and say, look at all of our data centers, but it's illustrative only. And we're very specific about the fact that we either have 10 or 100. So take this as a what we call the regional data centers. They are, you know, in the US, there are regional data centers in Europe, and then there's Asia Pacific, Hong Kong. So you have all these different scenarios from a data center perspective, and we treat them as the primary and backup within a region. So we talk a lot about, and there's some sessions this week, two of them around service management, security, trust, privacy. And we will go really in depth as far as certifications, the amount of investments we make around certifications. I really loved the keynote this morning with Jeff Tepper because he spent the whole end of the keynote talking about that. Trust, compliance, security, and us from a Microsoft perspective really taking that bet that says we are going to build the infrastructure, we are going to store data, we are going to do it in ways that are certified, that are very prescribed. We're going to follow ISO, we're going to follow all these different steps so that our customers can trust and build and continue to work in the Office 365 environment. So when you think about where data centers are, it starts with those massive global data centers, those huge footprints, the generation 3, generation 4, next generation data centers, and then it moves out into a core network, a CDN, where basically, you know, a lot of customers come to us and we travel around the world and we go to Latin America and a customer says, why isn't your data center in my country? Or we go to Australia and they say, why isn't your data center in our country? And there are many reasons for where we put data centers, where power is, where hydroelectric plants are, where you don't have too many natural disasters. But then we build the CDN out to our customers as deeply as we can. So it's about extending the Microsoft global network, which is, the last I was looking, the third largest in the world. So you take all of the carriers in the world, plus Microsoft's own network, and it's third largest in the world, based on the data from last year or so. And then we push out as deep as we can into these CDNs so that as soon as you as a customer are trying to access Office 365, wherever you are in the world, you're jumping on the Microsoft network as quickly as we can. So you have these massive data centers, the data resides in those regional locations, CDNs to push information out, and then it goes down to really the core network. And you see all the flashing, zooming bits going around. But that is the Microsoft network. And we want to get as close as we can to our customers. And that's really from a strategy perspective where we land. It's not about those giant data centers being in every place in the globe. It's about our network being accessible very quickly. And you'll see as we zoom in, and I live in the US, so I chose the US to zoom in on, but so bear with me. You have those core data centers, which are the backbone, and then it goes out to the edge nodes. And these edge nodes are going out to providers. They're going really from a peering perspective. Well, we're peering with all of the internet providers. And then it goes out to the metro solutions. So our network expanding into as close as we can to your ISP. And we are tracking and monitoring and making sure that all of those bits from you trying to upload a SharePoint file to Outlook web access to all of the communications are happening across our network as close as we can possibly get. So as you go down from a core data center to an edge node to a metro solution, and then all the way out to the last mile. And what's the last mile? Well, we have a browser. We have apps within browsers, but we also have actual applications that run on desktops. And those applications can work in a peer-to-peer mode, something like Link Online. When I'm sharing video or voice through Link with another user, it's going peer-to-peer. So I'm using those last mile connections, maybe even within your own network, to be able to connect. So it's not having to go all the way back to the data center, you know, hopping through Metro to Edge to the core. It's actually using the clients and using the capability of client software instead of just through a browser where I'm getting my view of the world. So we extend the network out as far as we can from a footprint. We then extend it in as deep as we can to the metro solution. And then we layer on top smart quality of service, applications, locally running so that you can have a great experience. You know, caching, downloading, really having that offline access. That's one of the things that we get questions from a technical side is people still don't quite understand that Office 365 is the Office client. It's a client. It runs on your machine. You install it. I'm going to show you what that looks like today in a little bit of a demo, but true clients, and we've done it in very new and really amazing ways using Click to Run, but we'll show you a little bit about how that full client comes down. You run it locally, and it's available offline. So getting back into the core components of those data centers, I'm going to kick it back to Alistair and let him talk a little bit about the operations side from a data center perspective.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, so there's inside of the data center itself, it's kind of an interesting situation. These global data centers run by a global foundation team are serving up all the different cloud workloads and services from Microsoft, even down to things like Windows Update, Office Clip Art, Xbox Music, Xbox One, they all come out of these same global foundation data centers as well. And it may surprise you to hear that, you know, our engineers, our data center engineers that work in these global foundation team aren't really IT guys. That's not really their focus. For them, they consider themselves more of a landlord, you know, lording over these 50,000 servers and those sorts of things. And turns out that this IT load's kind of a bit of a noisy tenant. It only has two requirements, power, and it generates a whole lot of waste in the form of heat. And so our data center engineers are really focused on that. They're electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, you know, they have degrees in things like thermodynamics, because that's really the core problem to solve, one of the economics problems to solve with these data centers as well. Everything else we can kind of do remotely. So when you think about a data center, and you think about kind of the traditional model of a data center, you have that IT load, and to get to that power supply, you need UPSs, generators, transformers, other generators, and then to get to, you know, to take that heat out, you need air conditioners or computer room air conditioners, which have chillers and condensers and cooling towers and a ready access to water supply as well. So all these sorts of things are just extra components and extra pieces of potential failure in the system itself. Which essentially all these things need to happen to make that IT load happy as well. So kind of show you just an example of what these sort of data centers look like now. Kind of like these slides. It makes me feel like I'm on the Discovery Channel, one of those superstructures sessions as well. This may look pretty familiar to you. This is one of our sort of indoor co-located data centers. You'll note a couple of things here. You note that this is a particular room. It has a security access control at the end of the room as well. You can see all the racks here that look fairly traditional. You can see that fiber backbone across the top connecting all those racks together. And you can see locks on those racks. You would see locks on every individual server, and you can even see here that we actually have tags on all of these servers to indicate what level of security or policy this particular data has on it. You can imagine that these tags being red, shaped like stop signs, are probably pretty important. One of the things that I'm always amazed about data centers, and if you've been around IT a while, you've probably been in your fair share of server rooms, and you know that they're really, really messy with cabling and those sorts of things. But cabling introduces another challenge inside of the data center. We want to take out any of the potential confusion that could be caused like that. So we have really specific guidelines of how we even do cabling, which colors go where, how to plug it in, how to wire it, how to tape up the cables, and all these sorts of things. There's a manual of style about that thick of how we build these data centers and how we connect it all together as well. And we try to modularize everything that we can inside of these data centers as well. You can see here some of the air handling units to provide cooling inside of this data center building itself. These are big units, high redundancy built in, and they're componentized, so if something does go wrong, it's very easy for us to pull out the whole system. We don't have to open up the roof and rewire the air conditioning or anything like that. We can just pull it out completely and put it on the back of a truck and drop in another one really quickly as well. That's kind of the beginnings of this idea of componentization of the data centers themselves. And that's kind of a pretty traditional look at a data center. You might see a lot of other data centers that operate like this. Maybe not at the scale of a Global Foundation services data center, but pretty close. So we do take that one step further still as well. This is what we call an IT pack, which is a IT pre-assembled components. And this thing just fits together like Lego. What you can see here is that core IT load in that container that has around 4,000 servers already set up, already wired. And what we're actually doing here is we're actually installing more capacity into our data center. In this case, this one is in Quincy in Washington. It's kind of a dry place across the Rocky Mountains. But what you can see lowering on top is an air handling unit. What this air handling unit does is it helps control the temperature of that component, that IT load itself. So essentially what happens in this particular instance, there's no electricity, no chilled air conditioning used to keep these data centers cool. All of these servers set up, ready to run, and we know from running all of our servers that we don't need to run them as cold as we necessarily do. The big problem we have in a data center isn't so much the heat, it's actually the airflow. You know, when air just kind of gets trapped in places and doesn't move around, it starts to heat and it kind of overheats and overheats and overheats, and then you have problems inside of the data center. But if you have a very good airflow going through that server, you don't need to run it as cold as we often do in our kind of server rooms built into closets and those sorts of things. And so what you see this on top is this air handling unit, and essentially in front of that IT load, we'll stick some louvers, and just the natural breeze of the air will come through. The servers will just naturally pull that air through the servers, and we just drop essentially a Hessian sheet in front of that, and we keep that Hessian sheet moist with water so that as the air blows through, it controls the temperature, but also controls the humidity inside of this container as well. And that's really important as well. You don't want it to be too dry. In too dry, you get static buildup, and you don't want to be too wet, because in too wet, you get humidity. And so that simple Hessian cooling, it's called adiabatic cooling, that simple approach keeps that those servers operating at a steady temperature as well. Now, what if it gets too cold? If it gets too cold, then we have another problem as well. And so what happens, that air handling unit you see there, you can see there's louvers on the side of it. Essentially what happens is that the air will rise between those servers and just essentially go out the top and vent out the top. But if the temperature drops too much, we just open up those louvers and we pass some of that hot air back into the intake valves to control the temperature that way. So it's a really simple and economical way to control the temperature of these particular units themselves. We don't actually use any power to run the cooling of that particular system. The only power we need is essentially for monitoring, maintenance, opening up louvers when we need them, and those sorts of things as well. And so essentially these just fit together like Lego blocks, and this is what a modern data center looks like. You can see there the cooling vents on the front, you can see the air handling unit on the top, and you can see that core IT load there in the front as well. We still put doors on them. I think some things are just a kind of legacy there, and I'm sure over time we won't even have doors on these servers. We don't really open them up, go in there and change servers. We just wait until a certain amount of those servers have failed, and then we replace the entire unit itself when it drops below capacity as well. And these things are just built, set up like this. They run outside and a security perimeter around them, and only three connections that come out of these boxes. Call it the ping, the pipe, and the power. The network, the water, just garden hose pressure water, and the power supply for those units as well, then off and running. We can install these things in about 8 hours and add 4,000 units of capacity into our global data center network as well. Everything else is controlled remotely. The building of those servers, the provisioning of that sort of stuff, is all done remotely. It doesn't need to be done at the data center location as well. Everything else is accessible over IP. We can even hard reset a server based on controlling the IP of the power switch or the power plug that it's going into itself as well. So kind of the key point here is that Office 365 infrastructure is really a data center within a data center. We have shared mechanical and electrical investments with all the other cloud services at Microsoft. We use that shared global fiber network. It's one of the fastest in the world. But then it's a separate internal network, separate hardware and storage, separate encryption procedures, separate compliance policies, separate access control of who can access the physical infrastructure inside of that infrastructure itself. So that's kind of the physical architecture, if you like. Let's dive into the logical architecture of how Office 365 all plugs together as well. So it's best not to think of Office 365 as one cloud service. It really is it's a cohesive set of federated services and many different federated services as well. So on one level, there's the user productivity applications, things like Office, Project, Visio, Office Mobile, Office Online, the new name for the Office web apps, are all kind of your user productivity services that are available through Office 365. And then, of course, we have organizational productivity services, Exchange, SharePoint, Link, Yammer, all these kind of services as well. This is just some of the services. We have a whole lot of other services as well. You've kind of seen us, and hopefully you noticed in the keynote and all the sessions that you see today that we're gradually componentizing out all these platforms as well. It's not just a matter of having one big honking server that can do everything. You know, and I remember the old days where we had the pie diagram of all the different things that SharePoint could do okay at, none of them we did that great at. But that was the value, right? You could put one in server that would do a whole lot of different things rather than put in eight different servers. When it's us controlling the servers, then we can afford to put in eight servers or 80,000, as the case may be, in these particular services as well. So breaking up those organizational productivity services into even more loosely coupled and highly cohesive services means that we can change them at a much rapid pace as well. And there are also other services, the sort of shared platform services that underlie all these things that your users may see directly. Things like provisioning, update automation, identity management, access control, system monitoring, the commerce platform to assign licenses and users. And then, of course, under that, it's sort of the management services that underpin this cloud service as well. And you'd be surprised to know, some of these aren't really technical services. Some of these are people services. It's having engineers on call from the development team, from the product group directly, that are actually in charge of monitoring that service. It's the SharePoint team that runs SharePoint Online. They build it, they run it. The Exchange team runs Exchange Online. We have service operations approaches, consolidated reporting, auditing and compliance policies that all underpin this kind of services mesh, if you like, of these cohesive services. They're also loosely coupled. We absolutely don't want something going wrong in the SharePoint search index to crash Exchange. We don't want something wrong in Windows Azure Active Directory to affect something else. We don't want Yammer. We really want to isolate that failure domain as small as possible. And so that's about loosely coupling these services so they're all relatively independent. They can run without the other services there as well. You know, isolating these components as much as possible really helps us reduce the kind of notion of a failure cascade where more and more things crash. And then we can replicate that kind of information across all the different services, the different data centers, different parts of those data centers as well. So we have geographic failover inside of that service as well. So there's a lot of different services we could dive into and show you kind of a bit more of behind the scenes. But in the interest of time, we just want to focus on a couple of them. Love to chat to you about many more of these other services, but we only have 75 minutes, and I don't want to be here at 9 o'clock still talking to you about these things. We can do that downstairs at the booth. So let's start with SharePoint Online. This is, of course, the SharePoint conference. Ben Canning is running a great session. You can see the recording where he'll go deep dive into the SharePoint Online architecture as well as the upcoming changes to that SharePoint Online architecture. But I just want to give you a very high-level view of kind of the SharePoint architecture. You know, SharePoint, really, it's kind of a fairly standard architecture. If you've been doing any web work for the last 15 years, you probably recognize this kind of three-tier approach of the database tier, the application tier and the web tier. So that's really SharePoint on-prem, online. It's SharePoint itself, so everything is going to kind of look like this model as well. The difference really is how we scale that model out inside of SharePoint Online. So to give you an idea of how SharePoint delivers that kind of core platform at scale, we're going to start with the simple building blocks. We start, of course, Active Directory. And even though Office 365 uses the Windows Azure Active Directory, every service actually keeps a replicated copy of that Active Directory just in case the Azure AD service goes down as well. So they're all kind of federated essentially inside of the data center as well between all these different workloads. Of course, SQL. SQL is that level building block inside of SharePoint. Content farms, web front ends, CA, sandbox, timer jobs, app servers. And then, of course, your federated services as well inside of Office 365. We kind of wrap all this up. It would be really hard for us to manage all those individual components. So essentially what we do is we wrap up all those components and we treat that as what we call a stamp. And a stamp is essentially a group of about between 150 and 250,000 user capacity at a time. And so for us to roll out stamps, it's much easier than worrying about particular servers inside of SharePoint as well. Everything in this environment is run on Hyper-V. Everything's a virtual server. So it makes it really easy for us to stamp out these stamps, hence the term, and add capacity in that model as well. So on one stamp, you're actually spread across multiple stamps, so your data is replicated within the data center here, and together that group of stamps is something that we call a network. And a network has some other things just to keep those stamps running, things like System Center Operations Manager, things like controllers to control the synchronization of Active Directory into those different stamps, DNS services, web services, SMTP gateways, all those sorts of things as well. And of course, network load balancing to spread the load across those networks inside of that data center as well. In the case of SharePoint, we kind of operate it as a hot, cold model inside of SharePoint Online specifically. So there's a disaster recovery data center. Generally, each region has more than one data center. And so you'll be operating out of one. In the case of, say, Asia Pacific, you'll have half of the tenants, operating out of Singapore, the other half of the tenants operating out of Hong Kong, and having the failure in the disaster recovery data center in the opposite data center and that sort of approach as well. So now you have spread, you have geographical redundancy spread across that environment. And there's a few other custom things on top of this. I mean, all of this is pretty standard SharePoint. You could build it yourself if you had $3 billion to spend on a SharePoint infrastructure. But where some of the magic comes in is the grid manager, things to manage this really complicated area of networks and stamps and data centers, make sure it's provisioned, make sure every tenant is spread over enough infrastructure so that it's isolated for failures, and then, of course, managing the tenants, managing the commerce backend, managing the incidents, and connecting to Azure and the content delivery networks as well in this environment as well. So to kind of simplify that view down, let me give you an example of just saving a file into SharePoint or into OneDrive. So essentially, you save a document, and there's one copy of that document on a disk. And of course, that's in a SQL database somewhere. Running on RAID 10, there's two copies of that particular disk. Maybe you go that far in your own SharePoint environment. I'd hope you do. Maybe you go even further, and you synchronously mirror that to a separate set of infrastructure inside the data center, and asynchronously replicate that to a separate data center itself as well. Now your failure scope is really the data center itself. You know, you could be hit by a meteor or something like that in one of our data centers, and your SharePoint environment would still be okay because it's running in that separate backup data center itself. Of course, there's scheduled backups taken to that environment and asynchronous replication across that just in case one of the stamps gets corrupted or something like that as well. It's important to note that these scheduled backups allow us to do point-in-time restores of the service itself. But that's the point-in-time restore of a stamp. That's kind of the smallest kind of unit that we can think about and keep the whole massive infrastructure straight. So this is not a restore or a backup that you have access to. This is something that happens, some corruption in the service itself, where we need to actually go back and roll back the entire infrastructure or the infrastructure for a big set of users, 150 to 250,000 people at once. Of course, for your own backups, we have the recycle bin concepts inside of SharePoint. So you have a recycle bin. If your users delete that from the recycle bin, the admin has a recycle bin. If the admin deletes it from the recycle bin, you've had a lot of deletes. And there's also a client-side cache of this as well. So even just that simple operation of copying that document up into SharePoint Online, something could go wrong with the network. You could go offline. It could be a really big deck like this one. It's 137 megs because I put in the video. And so if something goes wrong with that save, because we control kind of both ends of that environment, we know what Office is doing. We have an app that's talking directly to SharePoint. We know we can do an asynchronous copy of that information with kind of the technology that was baked into Groove back in 2007 and still exists as the Office document cache inside of Office Client as well. So let's talk quickly about Exchange. This is the SharePoint conference, not the Exchange conference, but I think it's really important that everyone understands this because it's, you know, as you see all of these workloads blur more and more together, for you to deliver something like e-discovery and compliance to your users, you need to have that foundational understanding of all the different workloads inside of Office 365 as well. So I won't bore you too much with the Exchange stuff, but this is kind of Exchange 101, how to fake it to your Exchange guys when you get back to the office. So there's two types of Exchange roles, mainly two. A CAS server and a mailbox server. CAS stands for Client Access Server. Essentially, that's the thing that you hit. That's the thing running the Outlook web app. And the mailbox server is what's storing the mailbox data itself. Now, you scale these out across two different ways. You essentially build out a CAS array. That's an array of all these client access servers. And then you build a database availability group. And a database availability group is a whole set of mailbox servers, and it's spread around that load across it as well. So that's really your kind of foundational building blocks into Exchange. We don't call them farms in Exchange. We call them DAGs or server arrays as well. That's how you can really give away yourself as a SharePoint person or an Exchange guy when you start talking about Exchange farms. So don't do that. Then, of course, we have an edge server. An edge server essentially controls that access to all those services as well. It's outside of the perimeter network there, perhaps outside of the load balancer as well. Important things to note. Every CAS server can talk to every mailbox in your Exchange environment. So even if a request comes in, it's load balanced to one CAS server, but the mailbox is actually located on a different server, it can talk to any one of those as well. In theory, what really happens is most people run the CAS role and the mailbox role on the same server, and you just add two servers, and you run both roles on both environments. So you still have the failover. You don't necessarily need to split out those roles so discreetly, unless you're running a really, really big environment like Exchange Online. And then, of course, just for more information, and I'll leave this slide in there, but I'm not going to explain it too detailed, but everything connects through the client access server and then talks to the mailbox server, except unified messaging. So generally, Exchange people hate unified messaging for this reason. It talks directly to the mailbox server as it goes through as well. So that's all you need to know about Exchange, because we're on Exchange Online now. But Exchange Online is built with these CAS servers and these database availability groups. And so our model for scaling is just adding more servers, adding more DAGs, adding more CAS arrays, and it essentially scales out really nicely in that particular motion as well. There's a couple of things we need to do to automate this environment, though. As we add more capacity into Exchange Online, we absolutely don't, we want to make sure that your mailbox is spread across at least four different pieces of infrastructure as well. You want to make sure that if there's one particular failure, if the server fails, it's not going to bring down the entire service for that particular user. And so your mailbox is spread across at least four different servers inside of this infrastructure itself. The other challenge we get when we're running such massive amounts of infrastructure is we have a problem that's kind of configuration drift, we call it. Configuration drifts a little bit like the butterfly effect. It's like that chaos theory of a lot of random things happening that eventually ends up to a really different and unworkable environment. You get these kind of emergent behaviors. You know, the Exchange Online environment becomes aware. and you get things like Oslo. No, just kidding. but you get these problems. Generally, it crashes. It doesn't become aware. And so to solve that, you know, every time you patch a server, you're introducing a slightly different state on that particular server. All of a sudden, that server is a little bit different to every other server around it. And that's a really big problem when you have hundreds of thousands of servers that you're trying to patch. So instead, our solution in Exchange Online is just don't patch. We don't patch Exchange Online. Sounds scary. But then we consider that the average lifespan of an Exchange server in Exchange Online is 2 weeks. We format, we reinstall, we start again. We essentially take that server out of rotation, we take the load off it, we wipe it, we reinstall it at the new baseline kind of patch level, at the new build number, and we bring it back into rotation as well. This has a lot of added benefits, is that when we do this, we're kind of getting rid of a lot of that configuration drift because we're wiping it back to a known good state. The other great thing about this is it's so easy to automate. You know, developers can build it, they just take the latest branch, or the latest code, and put it into the server, introduce it into the environment, and then it's very easy for us to measure. If we notice things going wrong with that particular build, we can take them out of rotation, reformat them, start again as well. And this can be done really quickly as well. We can push out a patch, we can push out an update very quickly in this environment. We can have every server in this environment formatted and reinstalled within 24 hours if we need to, if there's some big security thing we're trying to do. Generally, we don't do that. Generally, you see us bring out those features over 3 months. We do it in a very slow, deliberate way so that it doesn't affect the performance of all the users as well, which you might see if you're reading the Office 365 blog. Sometimes you're like, yay, we have a new feature. It's coming between 1 to 3 months. And we can't tell you when because it's kind of like a Schrodinger's cat theory. It's like, well, your mailbox moves around from all these servers because they're constantly being rebuilt, shut down, load balanced, and those sorts of things. So at any given time, there could be many different servers that are actually hosting your mailbox as well. It's kind of a minute-to-minute thing where they live. So let's talk about identity management now, and I'll pass over to Jeff to talk a little bit about identity management. Very important topic.
Yeah, thank you very much. So has anyone ever seen a demo where someone has to log in? No? Everything always magically just works? Click from one screen to another and you're in Oslo, and then you click over here and you're in SharePoint, and then Office is running and there's no logins. So in the Inside Office 365 for IT Pros session, we'll talk about why we build demos like that. Because it's really hard from a complexity and from a Azure AD and from a DIR sync and all these other words that I'm using. Identity is critical to Office 365. It doesn't matter what you're using, OneDrive for Business, standalone, you're going to have some sort of identity scenario so that people can log into that. Yes, we're making inroads from Federation and what you need to do to make that great, but every single thing, Link, Yammer has its identity that we're working with, Exchange, SharePoint, what happens when someone actually logs in and what are some of the things you have to really think about before moving to the cloud? Anyone here have ADFS implemented? Quite a few. Good. That's good. So in the scheme of things, there's a lot of advanced integrations going on here. When we talk to a lot of our Office 365 customers or customers moving to Office 365, they typically don't have ADFS. And Office 365 becomes the driver for ADFS. And what happens in a lot of those scenarios is that they start looking at their Active Directory and realize they haven't touched it in 10 years. They haven't done any kind of hygiene. They haven't really worked against it. And the cloud has a very strict set of guidelines that AD has to fit into. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that as we go through here and trying to kind of work through the start simple, move to the next step, and look at ADFS or solutions like that as something that you would grow into. And so we'll talk a little bit about that as we go here. Windows Azure Active Directory, it is the identity platform for Office 365, for CRM Online, for a host of other services. This is not Live ID. This is not anything that's from a consumer perspective. This is truly the enterprise side of Windows Azure AD. So it integrates with your platform. We have tools that we've built to help you get your Active Directory talking and synchronizing with the cloud. And it really is an enabler if you are moving to a single sign-on solution. And I'll talk a little bit about single sign-on and single login and what are the differences from those scenarios. But what it isn't, it is not your AD. It's not your AD backup. It's not you having your AD hosted by Microsoft. It's not ever your passwords in the cloud. It's either Federation from your Active Directory on-premises or utilizing password sync with DIR sync. It's a hash that hits the cloud. It's never a text password. So we'll go through just the starting scenario. If you went to office.com today, signed up for a trial, you would have to choose a name that said yourcompany.onmicrosoft.com. That is a baseline cloud identity that we give to you that you start with. Every single customer on Office 365 starts with it. So what is a cloud identity? Well, a cloud ID is just your entrance into Office 365. It's very simple. It's straightforward. You have a cloud identity. It's not connected to anything that you're doing within your work or home life or anywhere else. And it basically, as you log into Office 365, connects you to all the Windows Azure Active Directory services. OAuth, XAML, all the federation on the back end. Doesn't matter because you're simply logging in with a very simple cloud ID. Very quickly get started. So what happens is you need to build users to have a cloud ID. You either enter them into the admin portal manually, you bulk upload them from a CSV file, but at some point in time, you have to say user A is going to access my SharePoint site, and they have to have a login for that. And that cloud identity can be very quick, and you can do it. And so that is the most basic form of identity management within Office 365. So directory and password hash synchronization. I think it's missing a letter there. But Bob now in my org is going to log into Office 365. He wants access to either mailbox, he wants access to SharePoint, to link online. So he is going to log in, same thing that he has always done, log in online. Our IT staff has set up the Active Directory with password synchronization so that that identity gets created in the cloud automatically from your Active Directory. It then gets a password hash put in the cloud so that the end user doesn't have a single sign-on, they have a single login. When they go to SharePoint, they put in their corp credentials, they put in their corp password, and they now enter into Office 365. Whether you're using Outlook, whether you're using Link, doesn't matter, all of the services. So you directory sync your AD, which then provides a read-only draw from your Active Directory to the cloud. It builds out all the users. Your Active Directory then moves through. And that user simply has a single login that they use everywhere they go on every device, and you control that completely from your own Active Directory. I'll show you how this looks and how it gets set up. There's always a couple concerns around multi-forest and how we handle multi-forest, but if you're in a single forest instance, you'll see how easy it is. And it truly is it came out about 9 months ago, and when you think about Office 365, BPOS, we've been doing this for 7 years, this was a huge feature for us to deliver to our customers so that you don't have to go all the way to the other side of Active Directory Federation services.
Is everyone familiar with the concept of a hash? So essentially a hash is a one-way encryption. So we're essentially taking that text, we're encrypting it in a one-way fashion, and we're encrypting it again. And so when you enter in your password, the system will encrypt that twice and then just compare those two hashes, those unique hashes as well. So there's no actual password that's entered anywhere in the system.
And if you want to go 75 minutes deep on it, Paul Andrew from the Office 365 team, we have a whole session on identity. So I'm just giving you kind of the top level, thinking about what are some of the things you might need to look at over the next 4 days and really dig into. Paul Andrew has that session and does a really great job of digging in. So with Identity Federation, you have your Active Directory. You then start implementing on-premises hardware, proxies, reverse proxies, load balancers, and you basically implement Active Directory Federation services. What that means is you now own the authentication from your Active Directory. We have many, many customers who do this. We have many customers who have not geo-redundant, have not made their implementations geo-redundant, have put it into single places. And one of the big calls we always get is, Office 365 is down. Our engineers say, no, it's not. We're 100% up. We have been for a very long time. And the customer says, nope, I cannot get to Office 365. And a huge majority of that is their Active Directory Federation services is either down, not communicating, they aren't VPN'd in, it's not being controlled or configured correctly. So we have a lot of customers going through scenarios with ADFS, and to a customer, it's Microsoft, it's the cloud, it's what we required them to do, so it does become that conversation of, hey, Office 365 is online and running. It's your on-premises architecture that's not happening. So we don't like those conversations, so we try to really be straightforward about that. But Active Directory Federation services can really benefit you if you have client access control, filtering, you want to force people to come through a VPN before they get to the cloud. It's really two or three, and we have a great white paper about it, two or three core scenarios where ADFS is, should be implemented and helped. Outside of that, we see a tremendous uptake from the password synchronization. So that is the kind of quick overview of password synchronization, and I'm actually just going to show. Which one is it? There it is. Whoops. Sorry, I'm bouncing through here. There we go. So what does it look like when you directory sync to get all that magic demo stuff, to get everything working correctly? This is core. This is something that every customer has to really step through. I'm in my admin center, and I'll zoom in a little bit for everyone. And you can see that I have, a couple of users built. They have their .onmicrosoft.com usernames right there in the middle. They were built in the cloud. I can throw a spreadsheet into here. I can add users really quickly. They then have a username and password. They move through. Deal's done. Everything's working. The other thing that I wanted to show was you can also see that I have Active Directory synchronization says deactivate. It's because I have it activated. So my Active Directory is activated to flow into the cloud. And I'll show you what that looks like. But first, I want to make sure that my Active Directory isn't corrupt and going to have issues. So from an engineering perspective, we put investments into helping our customers onboard to Office 365. I work in the deployment team for Office 365. We want it to be easy. We want it to be safe. We want it to be straightforward. One of those things that we came out with was IDFix. We were seeing that our customers had X amount of errors every time they synchronized. Let's give them a tool to make it very easy. And we've seen AD remediation go down from weeks into just literally days by using IDFix. So it's a tool that you run, and I'll zoom in a little bit and show you. Just hitting OK, going through the scenario. It's going to connect and query into my Active Directory. I'm running it from a server that's off of my domain controller. It needs my credentials, obviously. It's showing me everything that's going to fail if I try to Active Directory sync to the service. And it's telling me over here on the very right-hand side, here's the update that IDFix can do really quickly and get it done. I can always choose to update. I can choose to edit. I'll drop down the menu and show you that.
I love seeing this.
Weird and wonderful things in an Active Directory that the cloud just simply can't handle.
Maybe rather than deleting users, the intern on duty at the time has changed the names to someone else. I've seen all sorts of crazy things happen.
So you can run this within your implementation or within your own architecture, get the list going, and then you simply say, accept, apply, yes, let's make these changes happen. One of the things that we do is you saw that file just show up on the left-hand side there. We create a backup. So if you ever need to just roll back, if someone calls you and says, hey, I am the executive vice president of so-and-so, and I had a hyphen or dash or something in my name, you can immediately roll that back. So we give you that full control from there. But basically what I did is I just prepared my Active Directory to go synchronize with the cloud. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to load up DirSync. DirSync is appliance-driven. I mean, when you think of an infrastructure to do DirSync, it's basically nothing. It's a role sitting off somewhere. It just needs to do kind of one-time workhorse, and then everything else is just a diff. So I'm going to walk through, fill out my credentials. It's asking me for my Windows Azure Active Directory. Admin out.
Great thing about demos.
Didn't I say you never demo by logging in?
You want me to tap dance for a while?
Yeah. So I'm giving it my cloud ID, which it's now going to log into using encryption. So it's all SSL coming from the Active Directory into the cloud. Oh, and it gave me an error. Sorry about that. One second. All right, start dancing, Alistair.
Yeah. It's a very simple tool. You can run it very easily.
Oh, that is just too perfect.
Clearly, it's not foolproof. Yeah. You still need to remember your password.
Yeah, I think I actually timed out and my time's down. So I'm going to try one more time. That is too bad.
But it's a little thing. It used to say that we couldn't run on a DC. Now, we've changed that recently. You can technically run on the DC if you want to. We still recommend you run on a different server. It is, it doesn't need to be high available. So that's one of the great benefits over DirSync than ADFS. Because ADFS, you have to have that high available, globally redundant or geographically redundant system just to run. Whereas DirSync, if it breaks, it's just not going to synchronize anything else until you start it back up again. And you can start it back up with a totally new server connecting to your AD, and it'll just carry on as before as well.
And all of this was just getting to a simple checkbox to try to show. One second. Oh, it's administrator. I was just berating someone about... Oh, look at this. Here we go. So the magic, enable hybrid. You have an Exchange server that can do hybrid. Checkbox. That's not all you have to do, but I like saying that. But it's asking you if you have a hybrid server. And then here's the magic, and it sounds a little bit ridiculous, but it says enable password sync. That's all you have to do password sync with DirSync. This will then take all of your Active Directory users, push them into the cloud, hash passwords. They can have that first login experience, and instead of the .onmicrosoft.com, they're logging in with your corporate credentials, their password, everything that they're used to. And so that is as magic as it gets. DirSync is now going to run. Anytime anyone changes their password on premises, it will change up into the cloud. Any more users you add in your Active Directory, they get added to the cloud within a timestamp, and that you're just simply moving forward. You're managing everything from your Active Directory. Users in the cloud are simply being created, and all you have to do is license them in the cloud to be able to be active. So that runs through Active Directory. It's now going up into the cloud. It takes about 5 minutes. If you have 50,000 or 5,000 or a lot of records, it's going to take a few more minutes that first run. But then after that, it just quickly goes through. So I wanted to show that. And then before I talk about the Office client, I wanted to actually go in and say, you know, we're talking about IT Pro, Office 365. What does it actually mean to deliver? You saw identity. One of the other questions we always get is, how do you deploy Office? Well, we have deep level sessions about Office 365 Pro Plus. We have TechNet articles. We have tools that help you deploy from an IT department. But we also have it online for users to use. If they're using devices, if they're using Macs, if they're using PCs, I'm simply in my Office 365 profile as an end user, and I go to my software, and I see that Office is there. Do I want OneNote app for Windows? Do I want the Link app for Windows? I can literally hit install. And when you think about what Click to Run offers, you know, if you've ever installed Office and waited the 35 minutes, 45 minutes, or all the time that it took to install, then you think, oh, amazing, done. And then it says, hey, guess what? Office has about 152 updates that you need to also download. Click to Run runs directly. You see it streaming bits right now. It's telling me that it's getting started. And this is the new way to install Office. I can have old Office on this machine. This install will not corrupt it. You can run side by side. You can have users receive the new Office and have the old Office. You can make a rollout plan so that your users are able to do that. And of course, because it's a demo, it's taking a little bit of time. But I'm getting that welcome message. And what you'll see is on any kind of normal wireless, and we do this from our phones all the time during demos, it is literally a couple of minutes for this to get started. It's going to ask me a couple questions. And of course, as an IT pro, I can suppress all of this. I can run it through my own deployment strategy. And I move through. But I just wanted to show you it's installing Office now. We'll switch back to the deck, and I'll talk a little bit about that.
It's really literally changed the way that we even developed this round of Office updates. We have a process internally called dog fooding. We're trying the stuff. The daily builds come out every day. We have a significant portion of our Office team testing that every day. And the old approach was that you'd actually have to re-image your entire machine because you never could get the entire office, this kind of buggy pre-release office part out of the machine. So you'd reinstall from Windows up again every day. But now with this Office Quick to Run stuff, it's just every day we get new builds and new updates, and so the feedback loop is so much higher, even just on the engineering effort in building these client apps.
And so what I just showed you really quickly is I was downloading Office from our content delivery network. It comes from the CDN. I was simply in Office 365, but it's actually going to pull this from wherever's closest to me. We showed you a bunch of those CDNs on the chart. But I wanted from my work PC to pull it down and have the full version of Office. And I'll switch over in 1 second again to see it completing. Personal devices, from the user portal, from app stores. As soon as I have that Office 365 login, whether it's a .on Microsoft, whether it's ADFS, whether it's just password sync, as soon as I have that login and I'm able to use, I can start using it on my devices. I can go directly to the app stores that are native to the devices and pull it down. I can go to the Office 365 portal, pull down that information. So it's really from a getting people started scenario, very easy. And if you have if you're working with a business unit in your organization, if you wanted to show them some really new features, you can have them get started on devices day one. It really takes little to no time. Everyone asks, well, what's different with Click to Run? There's a million things, the way we package it, the way we stream it, the way we bring features down. But one of the things with Office 365 is you're running it local, you're running it offline, but it wants to activate. It's licensed from the cloud. Your KMS is in our cloud. We are handling that from a licensing perspective. If you have a user who leaves the organization, you delete them or get rid of them or set them in AD, that goes up to the cloud, they can no longer log in, you take that license away. You can do that very quickly. We have a lot of customers who build that directly into HR portals, directly into how they do their day-to-day business. So you can immediately degradate that so the end user does not have access or control. The other thing we see, though, from a perspective of Office 365 Pro Plus, anyone here use HUP, HUP for Office, Home Use Program? We used to do that. We had, you could buy Office and use Office as an employee of an EA customer. With Office 365, you now get 5 installs that can be managed and activated, deactivated as needed. So we see a lot of organizations enabling their end users to actually use Office at home, use Office off the network, use Office as part of that home use program. And it's all blended in on their devices, on their machines, wherever they are. And they still have to authenticate using the method that you choose. So I'm just going to go quickly right back to it. Yep, of course.
One of the things I like about Office 365 Click to Run as well is you don't have to log into the Volume Licensing Services Center to get the bits. That's a big, like, that Office CDN.microsoft.com, you can grab an Office deployment tool directly from TechNet, you can download that. You can run it, and you can run that as a service app just to connect to the CDN every day, if you like, to download the latest bits. And you can pull them down in the background as well. Because we're not trying to protect like the code, right? All the activation that used to be like the secret keys and those sorts of things. It's all now user-based. It connects to Office 365 and checks against the users you've added. And so the bits we can distribute as easy as possible. You can put them in a USB key, burn them to a DVD, download them directly, or set up a little service agent to download it in the background.
One of the things I wanted to show is that, yes, I'm on the show network, but I'm almost done with my Office install. But one of the things it says is I can use Office now. So I have Office 2010 running. I can simply go to my start screen. I see that Office is actually on my machine already. Even though it's not quite done yet, I can start utilizing Office right now. So opening up PowerPoint, open up Word, and I can run side by side if that makes sense for me. As far as an organization or rollout, and you can see here, I have my login, I'm connected to the account, and I'm running Office of 2 different versions totally together, did not have to worry about MSI and corruption and everything else going on. So Office is installing still in the background, but I have immediate use, and I can start utilizing it immediately from when I started downloading it. So it's really a great new way of delivering Office to end users.
And what you do see in this state when you're not fully installed yet, you'll see some features grayed out. But as you go to use them, as you mouse over them, we actually reprioritize that bit and download that bit next. And so you get this kind of interesting experience where Office is actually building itself while you're using it for that initial 2 minutes. But you only do that once, so try it at home.
And so that's the end of the Office demo. I was going to show you that my DirSync was running, but I think you can all see that. Go in my users.
Oh, green.
Hey, okay. Look at all that! All my users from my Active Directory synchronized into the cloud. I can now activate them, have them licensed. So everything from my Active Directory, and it's not just users, security groups, distribution lists, the whole entire GAL. So as I activate these users, they look into their global address list and Outlook. They have the entire GAL populated from Active Directory without having to build anything manually. So that just happened in the couple minutes that I was showing you the Office install. And now I'm literally ready to start activating users and allowing them to log into Office 365.
Okay, so let's talk about service operations as well. This is kind of the fleshy human part of the services inside of Office 365 as well. It's the people. Role-based access control, very familiar term to all of you, hopefully. This is the IT track after all. But we take role-based access control one step further in Office 365, and we add time-based role-based access control. So essentially, if you think about how you run a SharePoint server today, it's joined to your domain. You're logging it in with an admin or a service account that's actually on your domain that all your users are on as well. In Office 365, it's a completely separate network. It's not connected to Microsoft's corporate network in any way. So how do our engineers get access to it when they do need to do some sort of troubleshooting task? And they do that by requesting access through a tool called Lockbox. Let me just build this out. So Lockbox is essentially a custom tool we have to basically request a permission on the Office 365 production environment. That request is audited, accounted, and a senior manager on call is going to make that decision whether that task needs to be done in that tool. And Lockbox essentially generates a temporary user account to log into Office 365 through multi-factor authentication to jump multiple hops essentially into the Office 365 data center network itself. Before you even get that far, the admins need to go to a lot of background checks, fingerprinting, security training, and all these sorts of things as well. In addition, every request that comes through here has an associated service request number as well. This is really important because if you call support and you lodge a service request and that it's a particular issue that may need some human intervention to help resolve and someone is logging in, to help you out with that particular issue, you can actually see that. So you can see that in the service request log. You can also, in the case of Exchange, you can go into the reporting section and run a non-owner mailbox report. It will actually tell you, in addition to the users that have accessed that service, what other people that weren't that user, not the owner of that service, did they have access as well. So you can actually keep the Microsoft engineers accountable and see that in your audit logs, in your reporting as well. And so over time, kind of, we've really evolved this model of operations from a different approach. You know, the old model, the on-prem model still, is this kind of traditional IT approach where the service or the server is run by you, you're the operations team, and the product team is this faraway thing that you can just never seem to get in contact with as well. Your success depends on you knowing every single thing about the product and every single thing about the infrastructure and how you use it as well. Then, of course, many of us have moved to a services IT model, which is kind of a tiered IT approach, where you have a tier one operations that may be you. You may have a partner that provides tier two, and you may want to eventually escalate it to Microsoft support, and eventually Microsoft support will escalate it to the Microsoft product team associated with it as well. It's a great model. It's great for systems that don't change very often. It's great for systems that are common. If you've got a 3-year or 5-year life cycle of a particular server, that model works quite well. The challenge, though, is the time to turn around those sorts of things. The fastest time we can get you a hot fix out of the Office team is about 4 weeks for an on-premises product. So if you have encountered an issue that we haven't seen before, for us to do all the quality testing to generate it, to get through the escalation approach, to fix that issue, it'll take us about 4 weeks before we'll willingly let out that hot fix into the environment. Because, of course, we have to make sure that a hot fix works on all the different weird and wonderful systems that people are running on-prem as well. So when we started BPOS, the big piece of software in the cloud, we moved to this direct support model. And the direct support model was essentially just a very lightweight help desk which would prioritize the issues and assign the appropriate team on duty. And then every engineering team was responsible for the operation of their own code in the data center itself. So the Exchange team ran Exchange, the SharePoint team ran SharePoint, the Search team ran the Search service, the Link team ran Link, and all these sorts of things as well. And so at any given time, you'd have 10 to 12 different engineering teams on call 24/7. And of course, the engineers hated it. You can imagine that, you know, every time the phone rang, every time there was an issue, they'd have to stop what they're doing. And our approach, for even for the on-prem products, is if there's an issue, if there's a hotfix or a request, it's the team responsible for fixing that, is the team that built it. So there's no concept of like a long-term support team that gets outsourced or anything like that. And it's all done by the product group itself. So we take them off working on the new stuff, and they go and fix the old stuff. It encourages that kind of code quality. And we did the same thing with BPOS and Office 365. People hated it. 6 months going, woken up, you know, the 2010 wave is going to be late because we're not going to be able to do it in time. But over time, a funny thing started to happen. Over about 6 months, the service got a lot more reliable. And what was happening was that the engineers, for the first time, you know, were actually feeling the same complaints that we've had as IT guys all this time. It's one thing to escalate an issue and say, yep, well, that's a bit of a problem. Sucks to be you. Let me work on that. It's a whole other thing to actually feel that pain directly. And so inflicting that pain directly really helped us make a better service. We're kind of in it together now. It's actually made a better on-premises product as well, because now for the first time, a development team is actually operating the same services as well. Perhaps at a different level of scale, but it was a really important learning point as well. So we've also evolved from that model as well. Now we operate on this engineered operations approach. And this approach is really more similar to the core DevOps model, where we want to treat operations as its own defined engineering expertise as well. And this isn't an operations team that handles those escalations and fixes them. Really, the notion of this operations team is to actually automate any of those changes as well. And so instead of a tier one group, we essentially use software-aided processes to route that request to the right team. If it's something that we've already seen, we have automated, code-driven solution that can be applied automatically. If not, we wake someone up and they build it. If we get woken up enough times, the operations engineer will actually automate that particular system if they can as well. Such a much faster approach. It really emphasizes that software approach that we're very good at Microsoft, rather than relying on kind of that outsourcing warm body approach to do it. So when we think about change management at Microsoft, you know, I kind of mentioned it a couple of times, all these changes are done via code. Occasionally there are some non-code changes that have to be done. They get escalated through lockbox. Generally we'll implement them by automation, via PowerShell script or something like that across the environment. And of course the implementer, the engineer on call, at the end of the day, it's their service, it's their product, they're accountable for making it run, and they can veto anything that they think will be destructive to that particular service. Ooh, that was the B button, not the space bar. Generally, these changes are scheduled a week or four in advance. You know, it forces the person making that change to actually talk with their team, to really think about the team. And then, of course, we verify it as it goes through the environment as well. So essentially, one of those features rolling out essentially goes through a number of different cycles. And we think of this, if you like, as a ring or a pebble dropping in a pond. Then gradually, we roll it out to wider and wider slices of the Office 365 infrastructure. We start essentially the ad hoc environments that we use for devving the system itself. We do a pre-check-in into the core code base, post-check-in, which we call the rolling smoke testing, where all our testing team is just hammering on that code to make sure it's safe. And then it'll eventually get into that daily office build. And that daily official build goes into our test production. We start to roll that out in slowly bigger and bigger environments. The first people to get it, when it goes into production, it's actually the Microsoft tenant. We're one of the larger tenants in Office 365, not the largest, but we're also the ones that we feel most comfortable inflicting a lot of pain on early as well. So unfortunately, you guys get a much more stable Office 365 environment than we do. And so that's our service dog food environment. And then as we see that, as we see how those changes are operating, as we're making sure that it's not introducing any other changes into the service. We roll it out slowly more into what we call slices in production, and other slices in production, until it covers the entire production environment as well. Another important thing to note is this is the same code pipeline that we use for the on-premises products as well. There is not a separate version of SharePoint Online and SharePoint Server. It's all just SharePoint. Really what the SharePoint Server is now, SharePoint Server SP1, it's kind of a point in time that we cut, and we do some extra testing for different weird and wonderful topologies that you may be running to make sure it'll work on all of those sorts of things. But it is that one code branch. So all these changes are happening once. So everything that we see and we improve in the service eventually accrues itself into production. As you've seen more and more of these other services that are kind of interrelated, that's the only area that we get kind of challenged on. When we're really tying ourselves into Windows Azure, or we want to see Exchange and SharePoint and Link all running at the same time and operating in that combined model, those sorts of things are harder to replicate inside of an on-premises environment. And so for those reasons, things may not make it into the code. Essentially, it's turned off when it gets to the on-premises product. Okay, getting on board.
So, 5 o'clock, we're
5
there.
5 o'clock, yeah.
So we're right in between all of you and probably dinners and parties. So we wanted to talk a little bit about getting on board in a way of this service is built. What does deployment look like when the servers are deployed? Everything has been built, everything is ready, it can be consumed immediately. And so from a deployment in the cloud, it means continued investment from Microsoft to help customers onboard to the cloud. It means very focused efforts from our engineering teams to make their products easily integrated with from on-premises architecture. And really, it's best practices. Microsoft, ourselves, through our partners, through our direct customers, we see customers moving every single minute of the day. So it's bringing those best practices to the rest of our customers to say, this is probably how you should do it, or this is how you should think about deployment as we move through and moving to online. So that's really where deployment comes in from a services-related piece. And we have a methodology for deployment, and that methodology is called Fast Track. And Fast Track is a defined set of steps and experiences, basically Microsoft's commitment to our customers that says, if you do these things, and you're looking at these scenarios, we know that these are the steps you need to take. And it's on fasttrack.office.com, and it is our deployment methodology for customers, for partners, for big, for small. And it truly is the kind of step-by-step guidance that really works you through that says, you can start today, you can start a pilot, you can start using a service, because that's what it is. It's already there, it's running. The billions being put into it from Microsoft are there for your consumption. And you can start with that pilot, and you can move it all the way through to production at your speed, at your time, but we are being very guided with how this can work. And it also allows you to experience all the service, the entire service. So when you think about from Office to SharePoint to Link to OneDrive to Yammer, the intention of Fast Track is that you're not just confined to a single workload. You have the opportunity to really take a look at all of Office 365 in a pilot, and then as you move to production, as you move to purchase, as you move to the service, that's when you can really define down your scenario and choose which direction, which workload that you go forward with. And it's about that time to value. So you can spend the next 8 months trying to help your Active Directory guys get their stuff synchronized, or you can actually start using the service now with a cloud ID. And start to push some of those business scenarios. And when we think about business scenarios in Office 365, there's a bunch of adoption sessions going on here this week. You know, there's discoversharepoint.com. It's really trying to help IT deliver scenarios to the business that works across all of Office 365. And that's really where time to value. And from an IT perspective, being able to lay out in a pilot, what does success look like? What does change management look like? What are the tasks we need to do? But more importantly, how can you help drive business, drive a new way of working together through Office 365? And that really is where it comes from: pilot, deploy, and enhance. Try the service, use the service, use it in a meeting, download Office. From an IT perspective, we really want to have this open conversation that says, it's waiting for you, it's ready for you, start talking to your business about it. And I'm going to just cut through a couple slides to talk about where it lands. Step one, step two, step three. It lands on fasttrack.office.com. You'll see a bunch of race cars out here with Fast Track on it, so hopefully you'll get the picture. But it really is our guidance from Microsoft to our customers on how to deploy and how to move to the cloud. And there's one kind of big point here is that Fast Track, and we didn't get to really showing it today, but we do a ton of SharePoint work in Fast Track. And when I say we, I mean Microsoft provisions SharePoint content so that the very first time you enter a trial, you're not staring at a blank team site. You're not staring at a blank box. You actually have a year's worth of research from our SharePoint team implemented into a SharePoint Online tenant for you.
Let's just do a quick preview, just so you can kind of see the experience that you get in Office Mini
8. It's hard to see that number.
Yeah.
So I went to that link I just showed you. I typed in SPC 2014. I hit go on my provisioning, and about an hour later, the first time I log in, I'm an IT pro, I'm in my own SharePoint site. And I have scenarios, I have implementation, I have training, I have guidance. You'll see these getting started, HR, finance and accounting. Right here you see it says explore now because I've already provisioned them, but you can provision each one. And what that does is actually gives you kind of the model home view of business scenarios that help people work in a very new way. And what does that look like? Well, from an IT pro, it's really standard things, trying to really help IT understand. Fast Track is a set of steps. It's a methodology, and it's driving towards a cloud onboarding. And you have all of those steps from 1 to 2 to 3 directly into a SharePoint list, which can be exported to project, integrated with. You can mark your task complete. These are literally step-by-step guidance. You don't have to go search around office.com. You go into your SharePoint Online tenant. This is presented to you from the IT side. We took about 100 documents from our UA and change management, and we blasted them into an actual workable file within SharePoint to allow you to go through change management scenarios. I just want to show one more. Oh, there's the scenarios up there. All right, right here on the right, you have getting started, R&D, sales, and marketing. Each one of these is a site built out for you, for your end users, that has a vision video. It says, how would you use Office 365 together? It also has the getting started guide, and it has do it yourself. So literal click-through scenarios that say, if you're trying to talk to your business about sales and marketing, what would they do within SharePoint Online as a sales and marketing org? Here's your best shot at that. And we're trying to help our customers understand all the different ways you can not just only work with SharePoint, but across the whole stack. So those are there for you. Hit that. The code is SPC2014. It's aka.ms, FastTrack SPC. It allows you to basically provision this tenant. We'll queue you up if we get too many going right now, but in a couple of hours, you'll have a tenant, you'll get a welcome email, you can log into Office 365 immediately and see all of these business scenarios provided for you. So thank you very much for your time. Hopefully this was really helpful, gives you a different view of Office 365, and you have a walk away with something where you can take a tenant home and really test out and show your business what's possible. So thank you.
Yeah. We've just given you 80 minutes of content for the price of 75. So if you have any questions, we'll hang out at the front. Thank you.